Hello, listener, and welcome once again to the Best Tankers Talks podcast. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to Barry Schwartz and Ernest Wong from Baskin Wealth. As you might have guessed based on the thumbnail, we talk about quality investing in this episode, although we touch on many other topics like why today might be different to the dot-com era, what disruption means for tech companies and why we tend to overestimate it, the advantages and disadvantages of leverage, the capex of the big techs, and many more topics. Before jumping right into the episode, I would be very grateful if you follow the show and leave a review if you like the content. With all this said, let's jump right into the conversation. Hello and welcome once again to the Best Tanker Stocks podcast. In today's episode, I'm going to talk to Barry Schwartz and Ernest Wong from Baskin Wealth. I would introduce them myself, but I thought it would be a better idea for them to introduce themselves. So I think it would be great if you talk maybe about Baskin and then maybe give a brief introduction of each one of you, of how you started investing and how you got to the place you are now.
I'll just quickly start. So Baskin Wealth Management is based in Toronto. We're managing about $2.4 billion for families across Canada, some in the U.S. as well. And it's really just what we try and do is own the best companies wherever we can find them and build a portfolio that we would like to own for ourselves as well. And the good news is that's the truth. I own every single stock that our clients own. Me and my family are the largest holders of the equities in our portfolio. And, Baskin, we're all SMAs. We treat all clients differently. We don't have any retail funds. We're not out there trying to pitch products. We're just trying to work with families and grow their wealth, hopefully for many generations. And I've been working here for, I can't believe it, this is going to be my 25th year. But if you look at, my face, you wouldn't believe how that's possible. The math doesn't make any sense how I could be working for 25 years. But that's the reality. I've been here 25 years, and Ernest joined us, seven, 8 years ago? Maybe even longer. I've lost track of time.
So I joined Baskin in 2016. Yeah. I joined more as like a jack of all trades. I was doing a little bit of everything when I first joined the firm, but then focus more on the investment research. And I've been here 8 years.
Ernest, tell everybody where we first put you, because we ran out of room.
So when I first joined, we were running out of office space. So my first desk was in the server room. So I was sitting next to the computers on a desk that I think they just found in a closet. And then eventually they managed to order some furniture, and my desk was right in the middle of the hallway. So,
but you said to me, you're like, I like it now in the server room. I don't want to move.
Don't remember that.
But yeah, so though we won't tell human rights that we may have put Ernest in a research prison when he first started. But the truth is, how Ernest got hired at Baskin is really an interesting story. I don't know if he's ever shared it, but Leandro, I think
this would be a great place to share it. So I'll get the exclusive.
Yep. So I studied accounting. So I don't. I had a business degree, but it was not focused on finance. I learned about the stock market and all those kinds of things in school, but my primary degree was in accounting. After I graduated, I worked as an accountant in the back office of CIBC, which is a Canadian bank. I worked there for a couple of years, and it's really not a great job, to be honest. It's kind of boring, like routine. You don't really, low paying, no one really wants to work there. So, you have to figure out what to do with your life. And fortunately enough, I think the one good thing about that job is that you have a lot of free time during your day. Because you do your morning work, and then you wait till the market closes before you calculate the ending NAV of the mutual funds. So you have a couple hours in the middle. So I was able to study for the CFA exams during that time. And more importantly, it was that the job actually did qualify as CFA experience. So I did that for 3 years. I got my CFA, and then one other thing that I did was that I started writing about stocks on Seeking Alpha.
So you're studying and writing about stocks during company hours?
Yes.
Yeah.
But no one cares because okay. you're not doing anything from basically 11 to 3:30. Right.
Got it.
You have a lot of spare time. You have to be there.
Did you say that you were working during office hours when in your entry interview at Baskin? Or did you not tell the story?
No. So there was a... Okay, so I'll get to that. So I started writing on Seeking Alpha. I did a little bit of investment research, but back then, I don't know what it's like today, but back then you got paid to write on Seeking Alpha. Like, you didn't have to be like is it called premium contributor? Is that what it's called? Something like that. But any article you wrote, I think you got 1 cent per 100 views, something like that. And if they really liked your article, you got 500 US upfront. Remember that we're in Canada. So it's not nothing. Like, spend a week writing an article and then I got $500. And then more importantly is that people start to read your work.
So, and the one question here, the 500, I mean, who decided if the article was worthy of 500? Was it Seeking Alpha or based on the views?
It was Seeking Alpha.
Okay.
Yeah, Seeking Alpha paid $500 per article. If they deemed it, I don't remember the term, but it's like if it's like a good article. So we got $500. I did a couple of that. It was like, you know, good lunch money. So after a couple of years of doing that, I saw a job posting on LinkedIn. Somebody in my network shared a posting from a firm called Ewing Morris. And Ewing Morris is a hedge fund based in Toronto. It's pretty small, managed under $500 million. And they were looking for a research intern. So I basically walked to the office. I said, I saw the job posting. This is some of the work that I've done. And I was fortunate enough to get the job. So
you cold called, you walked in and just dropped off your stuff?
Yes. So I think that, what happened was that I was probably the only applicant because the pay that they were offering is below what co-op students would make. So, and this was the fall term, so for September to December. So I'm pretty sure they didn't really have many applicants applying for, you know, a low-paying, like 70-hour-a-week job, right?
I don't feel so bad anymore about putting you in the server room.
But anyways, I got the job. It was a great place to learn the business. They're really smart investors, deep fundamental research into the companies that they own. And the first week I arrived at Ewing Morris, the manager, the head of research, he was getting married actually. So I asked him, what do I do while you're on your honeymoon, like when you're away? And so he said, you should pick a company, just pick a stock, any company, and do as deep of a research project as you can on this company. So that's what I did. I chose a company. The company was Methanex. They make they're one of the largest producers of methanol in the world. I wrote like a 70-page report on this company. It was super detailed. Like, found like the location of every methanol plant like in the world, basically. And I completed this report, and when I was done, my boss said, well, you did a really good job on this report, so why don't you send it out and like see to firms and see if they like what you're doing. So that's what I did. I went on Google, I searched like Methanex 13F basically, and then I found all these companies in the Toronto region that owned Methanex, and I sent out my report and I said, look, here is a report that I've done. I'm looking for a job and hope you appreciate my efforts and see if there's a job opportunity there. And so Barry was the only person to reply. And that's how I got the job here.
No, that's actually a very interesting story. So I imagine Baskin owned the stock at the time, right?
Sure did.
It was actually a sell thesis. Interesting.
Yeah. And that's a great advice for anybody looking in the research bit to get onto the buy side. It's do a deep dive on a company that maybe so if you wanted to work for whomever and you really respect that company, do a deep dive on something that they own, and even better, a sell thesis. And it turned out Ernest was right, because if you look at the shares of Methanex when Ernest told us to sell it, and he wasn't even working here, and so to today the stock has done nothing. So kudos to Ernest, and kudos at least to me for replying to Ernest. At least I really respected the fact that he did a lot of research, and that's how it goes. My beginning career is very similar to Ernest. I think a lot of young people who want to get into the buy side start out at one of these fund accounting, trust accounting type jobs. So just like Ernest, once you get your reconciliation done, there's nothing to do. So I'm like Ernest, I didn't spend time writing research reports for $500. I just traded stocks. And I was investing right before the dot-com burst. And so my experience was I would do an hour of work and then probably 7 hours of trading. And it turned out, that bubble burst, and then I started to actually have to find a real job to do something. And so that's our journey to Baskin, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And how did Baskin do during the crisis? I imagine it would have been,
crisis?
during the dot-com burst, did you get hired back then?
I got hired in the summer of 2000, so right before the bubble burst. Speaking of Ernest talking about honeymoons, I was on my honeymoon. This was before anybody had cell phones and could check stock prices. I got married summer 2000. I went on a honeymoon, I guess October of 2000, and that's. I remember there was a time that was when Nortel, which was the biggest stock in Canada, fell. I think it fell like 10% in one day. It never recovered. And I was in Jamaica. I don't know. I guess I turned on CNN or something, and I saw this. The Nasdaq was down every single day. I didn't really care because I was just a starting out young guy. I didn't know I was going to be at this firm for 20 plus years. I had no equity, no idea of how to research stocks or what makes in a portfolio. But our partner David Baskin, the founder, the chairman of our company, he didn't own any technology stocks. He didn't own any Nortel. I remember when I started at Baskin, Bell Canada had just spun out Nortel as a publicly traded company. Bell Canada was the biggest company in Canada. Then it spun out Nortel, which became the biggest. And as soon as we spun it out, he decided to sell the shares. There was people like to say, well, it's similar to the days of Nvidia and all this stuff now. But at the time, Nortel, even though it was the biggest company, was not profitable. And as it turned out, it ended up being a complete fraud. They were stuffing the books. The accounting was baloney. So, no, we had no technology, and we survived that crisis. We didn't do well. I don't think anybody made money. Markets were down for a couple of years, but certainly did a lot better than people losing all their money in tech stocks. At the time, we had a lot of clients asking to buy those dot-com stocks. It's no different than today when people are asking, why don't you own Nvidia? Or a few years ago, why don't you own this high-tech stock, or the weed companies prior to that? There's always something where people get YOLO or FOMO. We try to avoid that stuff.
You brought an interesting topic. Why do you think what's going on today, let's say with semiconductor stocks mainly and everything around AI, why do you guys think that it's different to the dot-com era? I mean, I I have my view on the topic, but it's natural also to see a lot of people claiming that we are entering a similar phase, right? And you'll see a lot of misleading charts like, whoa, look, the semiconductor industry now makes this proportion of the S&P 500, which was not seen, which the peak before this was the dot-com era. Obviously, for me personally, that makes little sense, right? Because technology companies were not prevalent 24 years ago as they are today. But what would you tell those people who claim that we are living something similar to the year 2000?
Well, first of all, we don't own any semiconductor companies in our portfolio. So take what we say with a grain of salt. But then I think there are a few different, it seems to us that there are a few differences between what's going on today and what's going on in what happened in 2001. First of all, the companies today are much more profitable and much less speculative than it was back in 2001, right? Like, if you look at the companies that are dominant today, and this is not just true today, but true for the last 10 years, like the big techs are, they do everything. They cover a wide spectrum of our life, right? Whereas in 2001, like, you look at the largest companies that existed then, like, I don't think they were dominant to the same level that existed today. And if you look at it on like a profitability or like a price to earnings perspective, I think we're still quite far from what things were in 2001. And now I think there was some things in maybe 2021, like with cryptocurrencies and those kinds of things, that probably got similar to what happened in the tech bubble, but yeah, I think these are real companies that are making, you know, real products that and in the case of something like Nvidia, there's no doubt that the demand is actually there, right? You can't just say that it is market enthusiasm or like market euphoria for revenues that aren't there. Like, Nvidia is actually making the money, so I think that plays a big difference.
One of the things that's interesting, I could be completely wrong about this, is a lot of the funding today comes from free cash flow, from profits, from real companies. Unlike 2000, 2001, there was no profits. It was all venture capital, stock market, issuing stock, going into debt. There was none of that. There was no company that was actually buying things that was real. Nortel buying stuff from Cisco with fake profits, right? There was, the CapEx was baloney, whereas you got the $200 billion, I think that's the number that's expected to be spent by the big techs this year on CapEx. That's coming from real profits, right? And so it just feels completely different. And, you know, our brains like to always say, well, this feels, you know, the valuations today feel like the Nifty 50, or this is like the dot-com bubble. We need reference points, right? You know, it's impossible for us not to use examples in the past. Speak to my wife about everything that I did wrong and that she remembers in the past. But, that's how we think, and we can't think properly when it comes to new paradigms in the economy. And it's very interesting what's going on. Maybe there will be a bursting of this bubble. Could be completely true. I mean, at some point, things will have to slow down, but it seems very fascinating to me that the funding this time around is all from free cash flow.
Mm-hmm. And I'm currently reading a book by Ken Fisher called The Three Questions That Count. And one of, like, the first question is basically that you should question everything that you know, because maybe it's a market myth that is not actually true. And I think one of the myths, I've been thinking a bit about the myths that I might feel that are true, but maybe aren't. And maybe one of them is that with technology companies, disruption is much, much higher than it was in the past, right? I mean, you hear all the time that, hey, this is a tech company, it's going to end up getting disrupted. But at the same time, the largest companies that we see today in the indices have been dominating for quite a while. And honestly, there's no credible disruption thesis on insight for many of those. So what would you, what do you think about disruption as a bear case for many tech companies?
Well, look, like, I think disruption is one of those things that you have to, like, obviously you have to be aware of it as an investor in the companies that you own. But I think that a lot of people, number one, overestimate the amount of disruption that can happen in the short term. Like, for example, like, a lot of people are talking about the impact of AI on Adobe, for example, right? Like, yeah, like, Adobe's not going to go to zero in like 5 years. Like, there's no scenario where that happens. Like, and I think the reason why people think that is because a lot of people are thinking to, are listening to venture capitalists, where they're, the venture capitalist's job is to think about disruption and things that can go to zero and things that can go up 1,000 times, right? But that's not how the public markets work. In the public markets, it's about finding, like, situations where, like, there's good value, right? And so that's one of the things that I think investors should do less of is listen to venture capitalists, because I think the frame of mind that you're using to evaluate companies is just totally different, right? How many venture capitalists were saying Google was going to go to zero when AI was first a thing, right? So I think that's one of the things. And I think, like, if you look at the last, like, even like the last 10, 15 years, right? Like, the world has not, like, I mean, apart from what happened and what's going on with AI today, I don't think the world has changed, like, substantially. Like, most of the large companies, not even the big techs, but, like, even, like, something like Domino's Pizza or, like, CCL Industries, which we own, like, these are more, like, they're not particularly technologically sophisticated companies, but they, like, they're more or less doing what they were doing 10 years ago, right? So, like, I think it seems to me that, like, yes, there is pace of technology changing things over time, but, like, things are not changing as quickly as in most industries, especially the ones that we're looking at.
Like, well, people think the big techs have become, like, for better or worse, they've become these platforms, right? And so even if there's some disruption on one portion of the business, they're just in so many different categories. Like, think of Microsoft, gaming, cybersecurity, the enterprise, cloud. It's in everything, and keeps on adding more things on top of what it has. How do you disrupt that? How do you displace that? Microsoft has been around now for 50 years. It's crazy. Microsoft was started the year I was born. It only getting bigger and better. How long has Apple been around? How long has Google, you know, Google has been around for, what, 30 years now? I mean, these are companies that are defying the odds because of how their businesses are set up as platforms. And I'd be shocked if they're not bigger and better in 5 or 10 years. They're the ones spending all the money on the research. How do you disrupt them? How do you displace them? They're paying all the top people. And, you know, as soon as that OpenAI started, you know, Microsoft was all over that, right? So they create the partnerships. And we're so interested to see Apple with becoming the aggregator of all things, right? Everybody wants access to their 2+ billion users who are addicted and checking and doing things nonstop. So, at the moment, it's hard to see where this disruption comes from. In fact, it's been the exact opposite. And those betting on disruption and mean reversion of, you know, their performances look horrible.
And one last thing I would say is that I think people often don't give enough credit to the management teams for being able to respond to things that are, like, that's their job as the CEO of the company, to respond to disruptive threats, right? And a lot of the companies, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit later, but I think what we want are companies that have, you know, like, they do a great job of responding to competitive threats when they arise.
And yeah. You have no idea what these companies are like. We're all reactive and we're going on Twitter and, oh my God, this is happening and Google's a zero. You don't know what the heck they're working on. You think they're idiots? Like, it's so so you have to take a step back and trust the management that they have a good handle on, and they'll adapt. You know, just like economics, business is completely complex. There's a lot of variables at play, a lot of things going on, and you know, we don't know anything when it comes to the day-to-day. You should never listen to venture capital guys about the large entrenched players. They give you the worst advice, and you should never listen to anybody on Twitter that's concerned about one data point. Remember when we were all concerned about Temu? That when it's going to disrupt Amazon?
Yep.
Say so. Yeah. Trust the research. Trust the management team. And best to be very, very lazy with your portfolio if you can.
Yeah. I think I see a lot of people who own a company and don't stop, like, maybe giving advice to the management team. But for me, that's like the complete opposite of why you'd own a company, right? If you own a company, it's because you trust the management team. And I'm not going to be the one who say, to tell Andy Jassy, for example, no, but money here is not well spent. I mean, for sure, he knows how to manage his business better than I can. And one thing related to AI that I think people maybe underestimate is distribution, right? And also talent. I mean, you can have the best, and Adobe is a great example. You can have the best, let's say, generative AI model, but if it's only going to be used by people who are going to play with it and are not going to pay you money, then that's not worth much, right? Whereas if you are able to put it in a workflow that is distributed to a lot of paying businesses, then obviously that's worth a lot. And one of the keys that I think people don't understand with Adobe is that Adobe is not worried about OpenAI if it's actually including it as a third-party model, right? They know that that's not the disruption. And I think people just probably underestimate how good the Adobe management team is. I mean, when the AI came around, everyone thought that Shantanu was basically stupid, no? He didn't see it coming. But he was the one who started the transition to software, and he got a lot of criticism because the short-term returns were going to be bad while the transition was underway.
Yeah, with Adobe, I think what you really have to admire about Adobe is the pace of that they're working at. They're announcing a new feature basically almost every week, right? The way that they've integrated AI into the workflows of their business, it has been pretty astonishing to watch how they've done that. I would say I think one of the things that is a little underappreciated about Adobe with regards to AI is that there probably is going to be some seat risk, so people canceling their subscriptions because, like, you can do less. You don't need as many designers or whatever. But I think the flip side is, to the extent that Adobe is making you more productive, is that all goes to pricing power, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Adobe's not going to be making less money. Like, if anything, they'll probably be making more because it's all, as you pointed out, it's all embedded into the workflow that Adobe controls. So I think that's...
Yeah. You've got to give credit, though, to a lot of these companies, for Adobe included, like, to learn a new product, to switch to Canva or start using Figma or whatever the heck. But 99% of people aren't going to do it. Okay, let's say you're working in an organization that pays for Adobe. Like, well, what is my incentive to go learn another product? If I'm working at a design firm.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the incentive of the management to switch to Canva or something else? You know, we get these points on Twitter where people say, I'm using Canva and it's way better. Adobe did this stupid thing with their licensing and I can't cancel, I'm switching. Okay. You know, those are terrible anecdotal evidence to use for investing. I really think people are lazy. I think of like my parents, they're in the 80s. They know what they know. Are they going to switch off? And they love Netflix now. They love Apple iPhones. You think they're going to learn Samsung? Do people really like understand how impossible it is for an aging population to learn new products and technologies and services? It's painful. It's not going to happen. So I really think these companies are just going to be even more powerful going forward. The biggest risk is what you're seeing with daily news about the EU. It's regulations on the big techs. You know, whether they've gotten too powerful, too big, that's open for debate. But you know, there's concerns. It's going to be like politics. You know, Leandro, your family's either going to be a Samsung family or an Apple family, and if you have a wife, or if you're married and you have a kid and your kid wants to get married to a Samsung family and you're an Apple family, they may not get married. It may be a deal breaker. You know, this is the way the world is going. And, you know, so it's pretty, I'm excited to see what happens in the next 10, 15 years for these big techs.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think the world outside of Twitter changes much more slowly than what many people on there want to make us believe. And well,
I
think
teaching your 80-year-old mother how to use the Apple iPhone and once she's got it and figured it out. Try then to switch her to a Samsung.
Yeah, it's not happening. Even if she knew how to use the Samsung, she would not change.
No, if she knew the Samsung, she wouldn't switch to Apple. No. Nope.
Yeah. Okay, so I think it's pretty clear that the investment philosophy of Baskin is to invest in high quality businesses. But I think quality is pretty subjective as a term and often thrown around when it shouldn't in many cases. So what do you think are the, let's say, three most important traits of a high quality company, right? I mean, we've talked about management, but what would you need to see in a company to claim that it's high quality?
Traders.
So our philosophy is that we want to invest in the best companies with the best management teams. And I think a lot of investors say this, but then they don't end up doing that, right? They end up investing maybe in a company where they know that the management is, you know, not necessarily top notch, or they invest in a company where, you know, they're not clearly the best player, but is available at like a cheaper multiple.
Mm-hmm.
So like the classic examples are maybe in the paint industry where you have Sherwin-Williams just clearly crushed it. And then they have a variety of competitors who have, you know, they're subscale, they have less pricing power. Everything about the business is worse, but then it trades at a cheaper multiple, mm-hmm. right? And so that's exactly what we don't want to buy, because what we've discovered over time is that if you're the market leader and you have the best position and you have the best management team, most likely they're going to find ways to surprise you on the upside. And this source of upside is something that is not typically baked into sell side models. Like, they're not something that is expected because it's unexpected, right? But they constantly find these new ways to surprise you in ways that you don't expect. And that's kind of what we're looking for. Because if you look for like a good business with established market position that is kind of what they do, like, I think everybody appreciates that business and what they're doing, but you're probably going to earn a market return because mm-hmm. there's no legs to the story, right? But then if you have a business where they're continually trying to find new ways to grow the business and excite their customers and add opportunities to the business, then you have upside optionality in your investment thesis. And so that's what we're trying to find in the businesses that we own.
Yeah, the best player in a monopoly or oligopoly is something that we would gravitate to. So those kind of industries, mm-hmm. high quality. Yeah, I see people, value investors that buy. I won't buy stocks that trade more than 15 times earnings. Say that they're quality investors, right? So there, it's impossible to define. It's kind of like porn. We know it when we see it. So we have a good sense of maybe there's 100 highest quality businesses, the LVMHs of the world, the Ferraris, the Visas, the MasterCards. Everybody can name them. And some are, you have to do more work than others, but, they have the elements. It's hard to say three things because a lot of them have very similar elements that we're looking for, whether recurring revenues, pricing power. Sometimes you don't want pricing power, right? With a Costco, sometimes you want hidden pricing power. Maybe Costco has that as well. I think one of the things that the combination of an unbelievable long runway of growth, as well as management with smart capital allocation, big ownership, and in industries where there's only a few players, that's kind of the bucket that we're looking for to find and invest in those ideas. And then, some of them have, there's pattern recognitions where we recognize, well, that's doing something similar to what we currently own, and let's attack that. But Ernest brought up the great example. We bought a spinoff, we bought a company called IAA, right? It's competitor to Copart. And we bought it because it was cheaper. And yeah, they're going to take market share. But what we didn't understand is how impossible it would be for IAA to take market share because of the dynamics that Copart has set up. So I think what we're looking for is a company that has created some unbelievable competitive advantage in their business that's going to allow that to persist for a very long period of time. And that's where we prefer looking. And then, valuation, so imperfect, right? To try and find, obviously we'd love to buy the best companies in the world at 15 times earnings, but that's never going to happen. And when it does happen, probably the world is ending. And so good luck to you. So we just, once we find and we feel that we can, you have had Francois Rochon on your podcast, and we share a similar belief that we're looking to have double-digit returns over a five-year period for that investment. If we can model it out from the initial cost, then I think we've identified a good opportunity. And as Ernest said, a lot of those businesses where we're identifying a double-digit return, they surprise us. They keep doing those double-digit returns, but every 5 years, they always look expensive. They stay expensive, and
They get more expensive.
Yeah. Well, right now is an interesting time, Leandro, because a lot of those names are at the highest valuations ever, and much higher than 2021. And mm-hmm. Who would have thought that? So the thinking in 2021, well, interest rates are so low, of course, stocks are worth 80, 100 times earnings. Now interest rates are so high, and yet those valuations are there. So invert it. Why is that happening? I think it's happening because we're recognizing how hard it is to disrupt some of these big businesses, how they've gotten even better as a result of the pandemic. Unfortunately, it's benefited them. And, I think people are maybe excited about AI and productivity for businesses going forward and trying to price that in. But, as it turns out, the returns from these companies just keep getting better, and so they're worth sticking around for.
Mm-hmm. I think also one thing that many people underappreciate, right, when they look at the multiples today, maybe they say, oh, look, compared to history, this is super high. But if a company has compounded at a 20% rate or 25% rate, then obviously past multiples are not really representative of what the business was actually worth, right? Because the justified multiple was much higher. So maybe it's actually trading at a reasonable valuation, but you're looking at a past where you could have had like extremely outsized returns from buying at that valuation. And based on what you said, Ernest, I think it was a very good point on optionality. And I also think that one thing that great companies have that maybe is not baked into sell side reports or models might be durability, right? I mean, if you see Adobe in 2013, you'll probably say, okay, I'll forecast, let's say 15% growth for 5 years, and then I'll drop it to a terminal rate. But then these companies still grow double digits 10 years later.
I hate terminal rate. because you're just picking, you're picking something out of the hat, and maybe the terminal rate will be a lot higher. So, you know, you'll buy a stock. I'm going to pay 30 times earnings, but if it gets down to 20 times earnings, then at least I'll do okay. You're kidding yourself. And 5 years is really not a long time, too, when it comes to investing. So, yeah, Ernest, go ahead.
What was the question?
I'll go with that question.
I'm doing some rambling, but yeah, it's very interesting. I wanted to just pick up on one point where you said people look at valuations in the past to guide them for valuations of the future on a stock, right? Oh, Costco's always traded at 32 times earnings. So, and now it's at 45 or what have you. So I'm going to wait till it gets back to 32 to buy. Why? Ernest, what is your thought? I've never talked about that as a barometer or investment thesis to buy a stock, right?
Well, I think the thing that people often, you see a lot of people saying, well, like if Costco was, you know, like 25% cheaper, then I'll buy the stock. It would be in the buy zone for me, right? But I think that logic usually assumes that everything else is exactly the same as it was, right? But then there's usually only two reasons why the stock would fall 25% or like maybe even more than that. So number one is if everything fell, like if there was a stock market crash, right? And then all stocks fell, and then you probably wouldn't buy it because everything was relatively as cheap or expensive as it was before stocks crashed. So there's no reason to buy Costco versus what you were buying, what other stocks you were buying at that point in time. Number two is if something about the company changed fundamentally, right? Like there was a narrative shift in the company. So think about something like Netflix in 2021 or 2022, right? When the narrative went from them being a pandemic winner, you know, disrupting media, to now they're having no moat, right? Like how many people bought Netflix at the bottom, like when it was down like 60% from the high, right?
No, Bill Ackman was blowing it out as fast as he can, right? No one bought it at 15. That's the thing, right? You won't buy these stocks at when they get down to those levels, probably the thesis is broken.
And so
especially if you do the work, if you don't do the work until it's down 60%, right? I mean, if you do the work beforehand, you might have a view of whether the price now makes sense. But if you start doing your work with a stock that is 60% of highs, then obviously, for starters, your work is going to be biased. And then you're going to rush it, and probably you're going to end up with the conclusion that you should.
Right. And like how many people were buying Meta when they were putting all their money into Reality Labs? Right, like when the stocks fall a lot, it's like stocks don't just fall 50% randomly. Like, so the idea that, so to some extent, you can almost say that you're never going to own some of these companies, because if it stays here, it's too expensive. If it falls, then you probably, the narrative has changed, so you don't want to own it anyways. So our approach is just that, like, we'd rather own businesses.
Yeah. So you look at Nvidia today, probably 35 times forward earnings, which is not insane for the, you know, the growth it's putting up, the margins it has. And everybody can tell you the bear case. That's what's going to happen with Nvidia. But if the stock falls 30 or 40% from today, and some people are, I'm waiting for it to fall. What are the reasons it's going to fall 30, 40%? And really, are you going to want to buy it when it's down 30, 40%? If it's down 40%, maybe it's because AMD has a new chip and everybody's switching to that. Then the thesis is done anyways. So I think it's better just to look forward and say, as you pointed out, is the durability going to be there? Am I comfortable with the management, the execution, the business? Can I model out a double-digit return here? Does that make sense to me? Am I really overpaying for the future? And instead of waiting for this, that, or the other to fall, you know, we're a little bit biased here. We don't run a fund. I can't sit on cash for clients. waiting for the best time to buy, waiting for the pandemic or the financial crisis. And chances are my clients wouldn't want me buying during those times anyways. And they're not going to give, unfortunately, they're not giving us new money at the times when they should. They're nervous. And everybody needs to recognize that with themselves when it comes to investing is I've already had three or four of those crises, and I've seen how people react. And the bulk of them don't want to put new money in and don't want to see their portfolio manager be aggressive buying stocks, even though it's the absolute right thing to do. So It's reality versus practicality.
And I think an interesting way to think about quality and something that I've been thinking about lately is if you invert the question, right? What traits of high quality companies do you think that people believe that are like super correlated with quality in a company, but that are actually not? I thought about this a bit and I can come up maybe with two. One would be capital intensity, right? Many people would say that 100% the business has to be capital light to be high quality, which I don't agree with. And the other one is maybe the margin level. Other people, and you gave a great example, some people claim that a company needs to have high margins to be understood as a high quality company. And obviously there are hundreds of examples why, or maybe not hundreds, but tens of examples why that is not the case. So what do you think about capital intensity and margins and the level of margins? And second, maybe if you can think of another trait that people believe is present in high quality companies, but it's actually not very correlated to them.
What was the first question again?
The first question is, what do you think about the capital intensity and the level of margins as a trait of high quality companies?
So one trait, especially in Canada, that people think is a trait of a high quality company that I definitely don't think is necessarily a trait of a high quality company is dividends. Like there's a lot of investors who think that just because a company pays dividends and grows it every year, that means it's a great business. And I think that that's just, that's just not true. Dividends are an output of the cash flow generated in the business. They could be an evidence that there is some like excess free cash flows, but like dividends by themselves are not evidence of very much, to be honest. And I think you actually see a lot of companies in Canada where I think they're probably more committed to the dividend than they should be because they've trained their investors to think that dividends are the way to go.
I mean, I'm Spanish, like 80% of the market here is paying dividends, and maybe 95% of investors are chasing dividends. So exactly. I have this one pretty close.
they're all bad. I mean, no offense, but most of them are just very bad businesses. Unless you're a sophisticated investor, very few of us really understand a return on invested capital, returns on equity, returns on capital. They just don't understand that over time that's what the business is going to generate. And we have Canadian telcos here. We've completely eliminated them from our portfolio. We have Ernest did research on them. Like they're barely going to do 6 or 7% returns going forward. So the best you're going to get is the dividend. And so, I don't understand. I do understand the dividend mindset. I know where it came from. It came from the fact that interest rates prior to 2022-23 were at a 30-year dropping market. Right. And so it made those companies so much more valuable. Right. And remember in the 80s when interest rates were 15%, early 80s, and then just dropped from there. So they made dividend stocks that more attractive. But what worked for your parents may not work again in the future. And, you don't want to own a dividend. How can you own a dividend stock paying 5% when you can buy a bond paying 5% with no risk? That dividend paying stock should pay 8-9%. And of course, with interest rates at 5%, it makes it harder for those companies to reinvest the capitals when they have so much money going towards covering debt and the dividend. There's nothing left over. So that's our takeaway.
And then with your points about capital intensity and margins, Like, I think it really depends on the business, right? Like, I think at the end of the day, what you want is the company to do the right thing, right? And I think the last thing you want is a company to sacrifice, you know, making the right investment in the business or you know, doing something wrong just because so they could focus on reporting good margins, right? So like Netflix, for example, like they, like in 2022, when they announced that they were going to launch an ad-supported tier, right? It was a total change in philosophy. Like they pivoted totally in a different direction. Market didn't like it at first, but I think everybody today would say it was 100% the right decision for them to make for the business, right? And another company that we own is CoStar. They run a variety of real estate marketplaces. They, it's a, you know, like the thesis was that it's an asset light business that has sticky recurring revenues. And then they announced a big investment into a new market, which is they're building up a residential, a website for residential listings. And they said margins are going to suck for a while. Like it actually, like the margins are actually like slashed in half. So quite a big investment, but that's exactly, I think if you're thinking about this from a long term, like the CEO himself owns a lot of stock, they have a great track record of doing these things. I think that's exactly what you would want him to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think very quick. I also think that if you're going to be holding a company for the very long term, you need to be prepared for a thesis shift, right? It's going to happen. The world changes and companies adapt, and maybe it's not very drastic, but it's going to change. And Danaher, for example, is another good example here, right? Before 2015, this was an industrial business. And then they started transitioning to bioprocessing. But believing that the thesis in Danaher has changed so much, actually, it has not changed so much, right? It's a management team and some founders that know how to allocate capital, and they are using their culture to improve all the businesses that they buy. And they are positioning the company for attractive markets. And what today is bioprocessing, maybe in 20 or 30 years time or 40, it's another thing, right? But there are some aspects of a company that glue a thesis together, even if the business is changing.
Yeah, well, we don't. I've never studied Danaher beyond listening to the podcast, the Mitch Rales one, so I can't really comment too much on that. But I think that, especially in capital intensity, I think what you have noticed is that there are companies that use capital to reinforce their moats, right? Like, look at something like Amazon, right? Like, the reason that they are so dominant is because they control, you know, the logistics network, right? It's not just because of the site; it's because they have the hard assets that is very, very difficult to replicate until you like go, you know, like until you build out all that to be able to compete on speed. So, one last thing I will say is that I think some of this has to do with the management's awareness of the attractiveness of the business, right? So I think a lot of, and I think this is something that Apple does extremely well, is that they understand which portions of the business are critical for them to control and which parts they don't need to be able to handle, right? Like they don't own their manufacturing facilities. Like they outsource that to Foxconn, right? But they control all of the, you know, the design and the R&D and all that stuff. And so picking and choosing which parts of the business to outsource or insource and where you need to own real estate, where like which parts that you need to control, like Apple owns the Apple stores, for example, like controlling the distribution. I think that's really important and something that I think investors should study more.
And you talked before about Copart, and I think it's a great example here, right? Because Copart realized many years ago that one thing that they needed to do was own the land, right? Especially because it was interesting in a recent conference, Copart's management said that if you don't own the land, then the lessor can potentially change the use of the land, right? When your lease is over, they can say, okay, now I want to repurpose the land. But if you own it, that's not going to happen. So obviously, you are putting your business, if you are leasing the land, in another person's hands, which obviously Copart doesn't want to do.
Right. And I think that part of that has to do with having a long-term mindset in the business as well. Because if you are in management, like if you're the CEO, you're hired there to be there for 4 or 5 years, right? Like, I think what you're going to care about is whether you get your bonuses, not whether you're building the business and owning the land for the insurance companies for the next 50 years, right? And so I think that was a really good point in that, like, I think these kinds of things can give you a hint as to the whether the management is aligned with the shareholders for the long term as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Copart is a really fascinating company. And there's a lot of examples of these companies that have the long-term mindset that are hurting, as you know, the short-term earnings, or their valuations don't look as attractive on the outset versus their competitors or their peers, like IA that doesn't own the land or rents the land. But, you know, that's where picking the individual stocks and doing the research say, well, you know, if it did this, that, and the other, it'd be a lot cheaper. But and that may make it more attractive as an investment. But the things that it's doing are the reason why it has that high multiple. And so you have to recognize that. All of us can quote P multiples and tell you the price of everything and say, oh, what are you guys doing? That's so expensive. Like, that's useless information. That's not helpful whatsoever. You know, explain to me. Don't tell me that Costco is expensive at 45 times earnings. Tell me why it should be trading at a cheaper valuation, or how I'm going to get hurt buying it at 45 times earnings or buying Copart at 30 times earnings or whatever it is. Tell me why it deserves to trade at a lower multiple. Don't tell me the multiple. Thank you. I already know that.
Mm-hmm. And I think a great example here is NVIDIA, right? Before all this run, some people were quoting the PE multiple for the last 12 months of a cyclical with depressed earnings, which was like kind of crazy, right? Because it's not like it was the first cycle that NVIDIA was going through, but people actually used that number to claim that it was overvalued. Obviously, now the stock is up like 400% and the multiple has got cut 60 or 70%, which is also crazy. So, and another thing that Copart has, right, is a pristine balance sheet. And I mean, when I say pristine, I don't mean that it's a strong balance sheet. I mean, it's a lot of cash, right? I don't know if it's 6-7% of market cap, and no debt whatsoever. They retired the remaining debt when interest rates started to rise. And there's what I see is that there's always, let's say, a discussion between an efficient capital structure, right? So let's say this business can have more debt and still have a strong balance sheet. And on the other hand, this management team saying, okay, we know we can have more debt, but we are not going to have debt whatsoever. So where do you fall in between both? Let's say between having an efficient capital structure and basically having a lot of cash just in case.
Well, leverage, I think, is a tool that is available for companies, but I think it really depends on the individual circumstance of the business, right? I think the whole point of having the clean balance sheet is, well, there's two points. Number one is that it protects you on the downside in case the bad things happen. But I think more importantly is that if you're the market leader, which most of our companies are, you want them to be able to take advantage of situations when they arise, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's really the value of having the clean balance sheet. It's not just we hold cash just because of we want to hold cash. And so we own companies that are quite levered, like Domino's Pizza is a good example. But in the case of something like Domino's Pizza, it's essentially it's a royalty business. They don't really have material CapEx needs. Like, there's not really anything for them to invest in because the whole business is just earning royalties on Domino's Pizza stores, right? So in this situation, I think you should lever up as much as you can. And more importantly is that I think a lot of the companies, to the point about being opportunistic about it, sometimes some of the companies, they lever up their balance sheet because, again, because there's an opportunity for them to make a good return on it, right?
Yep.
So MSCI is a company that we own. Like, they levered up the balance sheet substantially over the last couple of years because there have been opportunities for them to buy the share price at a cheap discount, like at a good discount, right? And so that's exactly what you would want to do with the business.
Yeah, and things change, of course, right? So Copart and CoStar and Berkshire have beautiful and crazy balance sheets today, but it's possible that could change in the future. Opportunities to buy back the stock or make acquisitions or start paying dividends, right? Apple has done an amazing job of delevering, the opposite of delevering, but, you know, really working down the cash on its balance sheet. And, you know, they've done an amazing job of buying back their shares, right? They haven't screwed up yet, right? Every share they bought back has been a tremendous value add for shareholders. So things will change with businesses. I think, you know, a name like Copart, clearly we don't know what the world is going to look like in 10 years when it comes to vehicles. And, you know, that maybe they're stalking and trying to make acquisitions to get into the more the equipment auto auction business, right? We saw that acquisition of Purple Wave, very similar to what IAA owns, right? By merging with Ritchie Brothers. And maybe that's the future for Copart. So you just don't know what the management is thinking long term. And, you know, I like to say that we invest with psychopaths. And that's our portfolio is filled with psychopaths. And what I mean by that is the management that run these companies, many of them are billionaires, multi times over. Are worth, you know, so much money, and they come to work every day and are excited by the game. You think of TFI International in Canada, Alain Bédard. He's making acquisitions left and right. He's probably worth $500 million. Mark Leonard. You know, these guys just love it. So one of the aspects of quality to us, the highest form of quality is, you know, management teams, owner operated mindset. That's worth everything if you're going to be a long-term investor. And our best investments that we've held have those characteristics. We've been invested with Waste Connections, with Ernest, who's a founder. What's his name? Millsat.
Yeah, Ron Millsat.
Guy came. He came back to run the company. Mm. And I guess he was bored sitting on the beach or flying around in his private plane. We love those types of businesses. You know, when you have a founder mindset and they've had some success and they've laid the groundwork, and just stick around for a very long period of time. You know, there's a lot of controversy right now about the capital intensity of the big techs. You know, there was a number of threads going around where, oh, they're going to investing in all this AI and it's going to lower their returns on invested capital and yada, yada, yada. So what? You know, it may turn out to be the best thing they can invest in. We just don't know. It's too early to tell. So, yeah, people are going to crap on capital intensity, but it may be gigantic moat building. And, you know, to defend a multi-trillion-dollar market cap, hello, you got to spend that kind of money. Like, what are you talking about? You have to spend a godlike amount of money on CapEx to maintain it for your shareholders. So I applaud the big techs for that CapEx. And even if it does lower the return on invested capital, you know, we'll still do fine. I don't think anybody expects that, you know, Apple's going to CAGR at 30% from here. That's not going to happen. But
I mean, it's probably a trade-off, right? Between capital intensity and the, between maybe lower returns and the defensibility of those returns, right? I mean, in Amazon's case, it's a feature, not a bug, right? That they invest in capital-intensive businesses because they know that once they get to the tipping point, basically nobody is going to be able to spend the same amount of money to go after their returns.
Yeah, I'll trade durability and longevity of the business over a few percentage points on return on invested capital. That is, that should not be a reason to be concerned about some of those big techs. There's other reasons.
Mm-hmm. And one question that maybe is, or one of the things that's most tough for investors, I think, is selling, right? Because obviously, if you're a long-term investor, when you buy a company, you do so with the objective of holding it forever. Then things will not play out that way. Maybe Ernest sends you a sell report and you have to sell your company. So how do you go about selling? Do you ever sell for valuation reasons?
Well, we trim for risk management. Like, you don't, I think, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that we're often managing a substantial portion of the wealth of our clients. And so there has to be some risk management involved, so that one individual stock doesn't become too big as a percentage of the portfolio. But generally, I think we try not to sell based on, because the PE is high or anything like that, because as we've talked about.
We would have sold our entire portfolio in 2021 or whatever before, right? Because a lot of them have higher valuations than they do today. And so we can't sell on valuation. I think we would know if something was trading at, 200 times earnings or whatever it is, just completely insane. Probably we would be aggressive on trimming it. But I don't think there's anything in our portfolio where we have to immediately get out on valuation. We recognize we're not idiots. We recognize that Costco or Ferrari at these valuations may not deliver the types of returns going forward. But there's other variables at play. I'm not running a fund. I'm not a hedge fund. I'm dealing with people's real investable wealth. Not institutions or endowments. This is people's money that they check every single day. And capital gains, there's new tax rates in Canada. It's very, very important. So these are the things we have to keep in mind. But we do have a lot of risk processes in place. We're not concentrated. We run 30 names or so. We try and limit position sizing in industries and different companies. And we do trim. Every time we trim, we get upset about it, but it's the right thing to do. Ernest, we probably trimmed Apple 5 times. Every time has been a mistake, but it's not a mistake when you're managing people's investable wealth. And Ernest makes the good point. We treat every client like we're managing the entirety of their wealth, even if they haven't given us the entirety of their wealth. And so we're very cognizant of that, and we don't want to have a blow up in any one stock or any one sector. So, Ernest, I don't think, have we ever sold a name outright on valuation?
No, I wouldn't. No, I don't think we've ever sold anything because we said, oh, the stock feels expensive to us. Like it happens on the other side where if the stock falls and then the earnings fall and then the multiple goes up and then you realize it's not as good of a business as you thought. That's happened before.
Oh, yeah.
Not because the stock price has gone up.
I think we've overpaid like anybody in the short term, but we have the willingness, I think, to stick it out for a long period of time, and we'll make mistakes on that, like anybody. But when you're buying 30 stocks, all we need is a good chunk of them to do really, really well, and that will overcome some of those mistakes. The one thing we learned in 2021 is, we don't want to get caught up in overpaying initially, so we'll try and be a little bit more cautious on the initial buy-in of the business. We learned our lesson buying PayPal at 50 times earnings, and turned out to overpay on what we thought was a good business. Turned out to be not a good business whatsoever. That was a big that was one of our biggest mistakes that we've made over the last 5 or 10 years. Aside from that, not too bad.
Mm-hmm. That ties great with the next question, because it's actually about mistakes. So besides PayPal, what would you say has been your biggest mistake, and what did you learn from it?
What do you think, Barry? You've been here longer than me.
Yeah, I mean, it was There's so many mistakes. I think what we've learned is we're buying better businesses, Leandro. So there's been fewer mistakes as a result of buying better businesses. If that's one thing that I can take away from it is, even if we overpay in the short term, the growth of the business, the returns will overwhelm us. The cost at the beginning of overpaying. There hasn't been too many bad mistakes. I mean, we bought Charter, I think in 2020, didn't do too, we sold at a loss, but not too bad. I mean, the more of the mistakes are the things that we sold early that we should have kept, or owning lousy businesses, or missing out on things that we should have spent more time researching because we were too stubborn. I don't do that, or, you know, I didn't have time to spend time on it. Yeah, the biggest mistake was probably PayPal. The other mistake that we did was we sold Meta at around $200 a share in 2022. A lot of pressure, of course, in 2022. You know, we're managing people's money. The market was very bad. You know, a lot of growth names got slaughtered. It's tough watching and living through stocks that plummet 40, 50%. We hung on to Netflix that I think at the bottom was down 70%. These are not fun things to live through when you're managing people's money, not through a fund, but the people that you're talking to, you know, daily basis and reviewing their portfolios. So that was probably the biggest mistake that I and the team made, is selling Meta at those levels. And we use the same argument that everybody else did who sold it at, you know, low prices, is, you know, they're throwing money away at the metaverse, and it's, you know, it's a distraction. And what we didn't recognize is it doesn't matter, because the core business is just so good. The core, you know, we didn't recognize how adaptive Facebook would be. I mean, there were so many arguments to sell Facebook. Remember, Ernest, what Apple was changing with targeting ads, the metaverse, Zuckerberg being distracted, 2022 valuations. Like, it was just overwhelming. And, you know, we kind of lost our discipline there. And that's one of those are my most recent regrets are Meta and PayPal. One on the buying and one on the selling.
Yeah, I would say, I think some of the biggest mistakes that we've made were kind of being driven too much by the narrative of the day, and not, you know, like, thinking as independently as we probably should have. So, like, we wanted to buy Canadian Natural Resources in 2020 when oil was like down in the dumps, but just didn't have the guts to do it. Right, like, we were worried about we basically made up excuses to ourselves not to buy it. Like, you know, it's like, well, like, we've talked publicly about not buying it, like, what are clients going to think, and, you know, all those kinds of things. And then we missed out on, like, a, was it like 4x or something?
I think we were looking at it at $50, Ernest.
Okay.
And it went up, and so we didn't miss up that much. Okay. We bought it at 70.
Okay.
It's that's pre-split, so. Yeah, I don't think we were looking at it. If you would have, you didn't show it to me at $10 a share, did you?
No, we were like, we kicked around at it. Yeah. But
then I feel like a real idiot. But we Ernest actually did the research on the stock and recommend. So we have an investment committee, Leandro, and of all our portfolio managers, and the trading team, and the investment team, and we present ideas. But Ernest doesn't just, like, show up with an idea, or I don't show up with an idea to the investment team. We research it. We spend time. Ernest and I talk about it, debate about it. I'll tell it, Ernest, it's just not a Baskin idea. He'll tell me I'm wrong. He's usually right. But, you know, that's how we come up with the ideas first and present them to our team before buying it. And I forgot where I was going with this, but... that's I guess with the CNQ, Ernest and I talked a lot about it, Canadian Natural Resources, before we presented it to the team. We had a lot of concerns. I publicly said in 2015, me and my partner, David Baskin, that we had sold our energy stocks. We didn't think they were good businesses anymore. They're very commodity sensitive. The big China growth story was over. The oil sands, like everybody are talked to, they're big polluters. People are worried about climate change. Do we really need all of these investments anymore? And that actually turned out to be the right move. I don't think energy stocks did anything from 2015 to 2020, give or take. They really took off after going negative and took off late 2020. And that's where CNQ rocked and rolled. I mean, CNQ, even though it's done very, very well recently, I think it's very similar to the price it was trading at in 2007. So, these are very cyclical businesses, but Ernest rightly so said, well, Barry, these are the reasons why things have changed with CNQ. It's now generating so much free cash flow and it's so profitable, even with oil, even if oil prices plummet. And that was tough for me to get over, is I really had to get over the fact that even if oil prices fall from 75 or 80 back to $40 a barrel, that CNQ will still be generating lots of profits. And so what we've learned is there's great businesses and great quality businesses that we can own and be comfortable owning them, but there's also great management teams that have laid the groundwork in tough, lousy industries. And we have a fair share of really bad businesses you don't want to be in our portfolio. We own TFI. Have had and do have right now.
Optically.
Optically,
they might seem to be bad businesses.
Yeah, trucking business or oil sands or natural gas. Those are not necessarily the best, the businesses that a quality investor would cite. Those are things that a quality investor would say, these are the things I avoid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this reminds me of a visual that... that I saw where you can see the different industries and the return that's generated in these industries. And obviously in the good industries, you're going to have a lot of players above, like generating value above their cost of capital. But then you're going to have other industries where those are the exceptions. But what I took home from that graph was that in any industry, you are able to find a high quality company, right? Maybe your probabilities are much lower, but there's going to be special companies, even if they're in the toughest of sectors.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be that outlier, right? And so it's really risky just to say the airline business or the oil and gas business or the banking business is lousy, and I avoid them altogether. Well, what about JP Morgan? What about Southwestern Airline? I mean, there's always, or CNQ, there's always that outlier that has some secret sauce, some special ingredients that an amazing management team that can really add value. And so you got to be open as an investor. I've made that mistake, and Ernest and I have, we're really trying to keep an open mind when it comes to investing. Sometimes we get a little bit too open minded when we bought names like a PayPal, for example, but that's how we want to grow as investors. It's really keep an open mind, and I don't know. Quality is in the eye of the beholder, and there's no specific criteria that we're looking for going forward for an investment. Bottom line is we just want to make our clients money and not take on a lot of risk. So if we can find opportunities in a crappy business, crappy industry, or something that maybe doesn't even look as good optically, if we can find the business case, it may be worth committing some capital to it.
Mm-hmm. And now the last question to wrap it up. What would you say is your favorite investing book, or the one that probably has shaped the most your investment style?
Do you want to go first?
I'm trying to think. You go first.
Well, I think two books that are probably the most formative for my investment philosophy are Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits. Just a classic book by Phil Fisher. Mm-hmm. I think every time I think that I have a unique insight into growth invest and quality investing, I read this book and think, oh, this guy figured this all out like 60 years ago, right? So I think that book is very important to me. Another one that has been very important to me is The Innovator's Dilemma, which I think it really helps explain a lot of the behavior and what goes on and the narratives that go around tech companies, especially the big ones. So those are the two books that have been important.
I'm naturally gravitating to investors that have a long-term mindset that hold, obviously, the Buffett letters. I have a copy on Kindle, right? So just rereading those regularly is just so helpful. I'm less about books and more about reading, the shareholder letters of investors that I admire or listening to them speak. People like Bill Miller or Ron Barron. I love listening because they share the same mindset that I have. Can't speak for Ernest, but of the types of investing. I mean, I love the book, The Davis Discipline, about Shelby Davis, Chris Davis's great grandfather. I mean, what an amazing story. I'm reading, I just finished the book that I gave Ernest a copy as well. Something from, what's it called? I'm on my desk here. What I learned learned about investing from Darwin. I mean, and that's the same type of mindset that I have. The investor that wrote this book owns stocks based in India, but those lessons can be applied as well.
I actually read that book, and I contacted Pulak Prasad and I spoke to him. Unfortunately, he didn't want to appear on the podcast because he doesn't go on podcasts or he doesn't have social media. And it's crazy how one is able to have the quality standards are very high. But not only that, is how you are able to preserve those high quality standards and not compromise them over so many times that probably you've had a lot of occasions where you've said, I like this company, but it doesn't mean like it doesn't meet the quality standards, right? I mean, I think it's normal for time to time to get, let's say, a bit of FOMO, right? I mean, you study a company for a long time, maybe it's not the highest quality company that you've ever researched, but at the same time you think the investment case is compelling and you feel a bit pressured to maybe not see the work that you've put in as a sunk cost, which I think is one of the most difficult things about investing, right? Is a lot of work that you're doing, it's not going to result in an action, but at the same time it's going to be very positive because you are going to train your pattern recognition skills.
All I can tell you is my favorite investors are guys that don't sell. Charlie Munger, Bill Miller, Ron Barron, Shelby Davis. The book I just read, I try to emulate that with my PA. It's harder, of course, when you're managing clients' wealth where things happen. I think people that really create unbelievable wealth don't sell. Peter Lynch, you just don't sell. I'm trying to get that across. I was went for a walk with a friend the other day, and we were talking about waste connections. And I said, yeah, I've owned that since, and its predecessor form. I've owned that personally since 2002. He's like, you hold stocks that long? And I'm like, I said back to him, he's a portfolio manager, and you don't. We were walking, and he told me about Adobe that he bought some and sold it like a month later. I just don't get that mindset. I made a $5,000. That's going to pay for my trip to Vegas. If you hold it and it does really well, maybe it can pay for your cottage in the future. Yeah. So those are that's where I like to learn from, the Buffetts, the Mungers, the Barons, the Bill Millers. Those are the stories and books and podcasts that appeal. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Barry and Ernest, for coming to the podcast. I think it was a great conversation, and I wish you the best of luck. I'll leave the you have a podcast, right? So I'll leave the link to the podcast and also the link to Baskin Wealth in the description so people can check them out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.